Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
In August of 2019, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times and a group of black journalists, historians, and scholars produced an entire issue of the paper's Sunday magazine. It commemorated the 400th anniversary of the arrival on the shores of Virginia of the first enslaved people from Africa. It was her conception, the 1619 Project, and it took a clear-eyed, unflinching look at the long, painful, and profound impact of slavery and white supremacy on the lives of African Americans in our country to this day. I sat down with Hannah Jones this week to talk about her own journey, her project, and our country's unfinished business. Here's that conversation. Nicole Hannah-Jones, it's so good to see you. And I wanted to start by talking about your story as part of the larger American story that you are charting with the 1619 Project. But talk to me about your own family and its history, which you wrote about a little in the preamble to the 1619 Project piece.
Yeah, so thank you for having me on the podcast, and I'm excited for the conversation. I start my essay, which is about democracy, with the story of my father. So I am biracial. My mother is white from Iowa. My father is black from Mississippi. And I'm the product of the Great Migration. So my grandmother brought my father and two of his young siblings up from Mississippi on the Illinois Central Line when my dad was about 3 years old. He was born on a cotton plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi. For those who know civil rights history, Greenwood was the seat of Freedom Summer, who was considered one of the most violent places to be black in America. It was a very hard place. And at about the age 3 or 4 is when they start putting the kids in the field to start bringing water out to the workers who were picking cotton. And that's when my grandmother decided that her kids were not going to have a life working in the fields. And she loaded them up on the train and moved to Iowa. So I kind of opened the piece with, my dad joined the military and served in the Army, and then he flew this colossally big, at least in my mind at the time, flag in our front yard. And as a high school student who was, you know, starting to become really deeply aware of society's inequities and my dad's position in this country, I was deeply embarrassed by this kind of outward exhibit of patriotism. It seemed to me that he was degrading himself by flying this flag in the yard. And so the project begins with that and how I came to understand that my dad was making a claim on a long legacy of black people who felt that no one had the right to tell them that this was not their country.
Did you have that conversation with him? Did you ask him why he flew the flag?
I didn't, you know, I never did. I understood that to have that conversation would have felt very disrespectful to my dad. So while I had those feelings, they weren't feelings that I expressed to him. My dad was extremely proud of his service. Like many black men, he saw the Army not just as a way out of poverty, but as a way to prove his citizenship. And so he was very patriotic. And I didn't ever have that conversation. And in fact, people often ask me, well, when did you come to understand your dad's patriotism? And I said it was while I was reporting and reading research material for my essay. So it was last year. I truly never understood it until I started working on the piece on democracy.
Yeah, you said he served to sort of certify his patriotism, his but the promise of of a brighter future didn't pay off as much for him and for other Black servicemen and women, but mostly men back then. And that's part of what you chart here, that these compacts were really, there was no sign hanging on them saying for whites only. But in many ways, that's the way it worked out because of the discriminatory way in which programs like the GI Bill and housing programs that flowed from the GI Bill and other legislation, they just weren't administered on the square.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a very long history of this. If you look, Black Americans have fought in every war, including the war that made us America, and have joined the military at the highest rates of all racial groups. And that has come out of a deep sense that in a country that has not treated you as citizens, the way that you can prove your citizenship is to be willing to die for your country. But unfortunately, Black Americans, for most of the history of this country, served in segregated military. They often had to fight just for the right to fight, at least, you know, up until the Civil War. They were not allowed to fight initially, and only when the army was or the military was losing were
yes,
Black people
depleted.
Allowed into the military.
Yes, yes.
Right. And so we have this long history of being willing to fight for our country, but then not being beneficiaries. We know that the Civil War pensions were administered in a racially discriminatory way. We know that the GI Bill was administered in a racially discriminatory way. And so, no, again and again, even though Black people have been disproportionately willing to fight for this country, they have been left out of many of the promises that fight was to bring.
So returning to your family, you mentioned that you're biracial. Mm-hmm. How did your parents meet and when did they marry?
Yeah, so I, to be clear, I'm biracial, but I definitely consider myself
no,
Black.
No, we'll get to that. No, I understand that. And, you know, well, as long as we're there, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You don't actually get to make that choice, do you, in America?
No, I think you can try to make that choice, but no, my father, I'll answer how we met and then tell you the conversation that my father had when we were young. So my father met my mom. My mother came to my hometown to go to college.
Waterloo, Iowa.
Yeah. So in the neighboring town in the metro area is the University of Northern Iowa. This is my mom's first time away from rural Iowa. She grew up in a very, very small town with no Black people in it called Swisher, Iowa. And she came to go to school. And my dad actually, as he would say, would go up to the university to chase women. So he did not attend the university, but he would go up there to meet women. I guess he liked college educated women. And he met my mom one day, actually on the way to another date. And I guess they hit it off and the rest was history. But my mother's parents disowned my mom when they found out that she was dating and living with this Black man. And my parents eventually, they had my older sister, and that's when my grandparents started speaking to my mom again because this was their first grandchild. My parents were married in 1976. I was actually in my mom's stomach during the wedding. She was about 5 months pregnant, 4 months pregnant with me when they got married. And of course, this is just less than a decade after the Supreme Court ruled in Loving that it was unconstitutional to deny Black and white people the right to marry, which is shows us how recent this history that we like to think is very far past is.
Let me just stop you right there for a second, because that is such a stunning thing to think about.
Yes.
Because we understand that the reason that there were these laws was that white governors and people in control did not want, they felt that it would pollute the white race. It's just one of so many different ways in which Black people in this country were treated as less than, and just so incredibly, you know, we didn't have laws saying you couldn't marry a Catholic, or you couldn't marry a Italian, or you couldn't marry, you know, that this is, it's just a stunning part of our history that needs to be remembered because of what it meant. But I interrupted you. You were...
No, that's okay. I mean, it is important to pause in those moments because we kind of just take it for granted that, oh, this is what happened. But it's good to stop and think about what that actually means. And again, how recent this was. a decade before I was born, my parents' marriage would have been illegal in the state of my dad's birth. Their entire relationship would have been illegal in the state of my dad's birth. And that's why when you say, you know, when I, this, you know, identify as Black, that there was not really a choice. I mean, in this country, we have long had the one drop rule, which was, as the anti-miscegenation laws intended to keep the white race pure. So any person who had any known quantity of Black blood was considered Black. And my dad certainly, I remember very vividly, when we were young, had a conversation with my sisters and I and said, your mother may be white, but you are Black. You are going to be treated as Black, and that is who you are. And I think he was trying to make very clear to us that you were not going to be the beneficiaries of your mom's whiteness, and don't go through the world thinking that that's who you are, because that's not how the world was going to treat you.
Yeah,
and I'm grateful for that.
That point, that you are not going to be treated that way, is the what I was getting at. This, you know,
yes,
beyond all the laws, the fact is, you walking down a street would be treated differently. You applying for a loan, you all of that was the reality, and
yes,
remains the reality in many ways. So tell me, you've talked about your relationship with your folks, which each had difficulties, it felt like. It's interesting to me to think of how do you, your mom was the beneficiary of the privilege that goes along with being white in a country where, you know, that was the norm. What conversations have you had with her about that, about the fact that you would be treated different? You talk about the conversation you had with your dad. What about with your mom?
Yeah, so we were always, I guess, necessarily a house that talked about race. I mean, there really wasn't a way to get around it. Because even though, you know, my mom's parents, they were great grandparents to us. We spent a lot of time with them. We went on family trips together. They lived an hour away. We spent summers at their house. We were very close to them. But they also were racist in many ways, not to us, but it really showed the way that you can have intimate relationships with Black people and see those Black people as exceptional and still make all of these racist assumptions about Black people writ large. So
how did that manifest itself?
I mean, conversations at the table about how other, you know, we'd be having dinner at their house or something, and they talk about something that Black people did or how other Black people were. I remember one time we were watching, it must have been during the when Jesse Jackson was running for the presidency back in the 80s, and my grandmother coming in and seeing that the speaker was Jesse Jackson's son was speaking and says, wow, he's really articulate for a Black man. I'm surprised that he's a Black man. So things like that, being, you know, not being comfortable going into Black parts of town, that sort of thing. So it was always kind of there, even as they were amazingly loving and kind and generous with us. So there was always this. And so my mom and I, we would have conversations about it. Sometimes I would clearly be bothered by it. I think she was a little stuck because these were her parents, and I was her daughter. And this was a choice that she had made to get in this relationship and have children with this man. So I'm very close to my mom, and she's probably, you know, she's about as left as you can get on every issue, because while she is white, at that time, choosing to be with a Black man meant when she was anywhere with her kids or her family, she also faced a lot of judgment. She also was treated as an outsider. This was a choice. It wasn't something she was born into, but she certainly had that experience of how you can be ostracized because of either your race or the relationship that you choose to be in.
As a kid, you were bused to school. It was a voluntary busing program in Waterloo. But you talked about you've shared your observations about that experience about feeling a little bit like an outsider, mm-hmm. and about the trip through town from the black section of town through the white section of town. Talk a little about that.
You know, I've spent so much of my career writing about schools, segregation, yes. and integration, but I didn't realize at the time that I was part of an integration program. I mean, when you're in second grade and your parents tell you you're going to a different school, you just get on the bus and go wherever you're headed. I certainly noticed that my bus ride got a lot longer, and the people in my school looked a lot different than the kids I had gone to class with, but I never had a conversation about why that was. I later found out that it was a voluntary program only in, and you will know this, that at that time, the Department of Health and Education was threatening school districts to either voluntarily integrate or the Justice Department was going to sue. Mm-hmm. And my hometown was facing a lawsuit from the NAACP, and that's what brought about this program. So the program got me into the wealthiest and also the whitest public schools in my hometown, got me access to the best public education that my hometown had to offer. But it was extremely isolating. It is hard to state what it feels like to be the only kids. The bus would literally go and pick up all the black kids on my side of town, which is why my bus ride was so long, and then drop us off to various white schools on the other side of town. And at the end of the day, we all had to get on that bus and go home. And all the other kids were walking home. This was their neighborhood and their school. And it was always very clear to us that this was not our community. This was not our school. We were being allowed to come there to get something and then, you know, to go back home. So my school friends and my home, you know, my neighborhood friends were completely different. They never mixed. My white school friends could never come to my house. They could never come to anything on our side of the town. I could only ever go to their houses or the parks on their side of the town. So even at a really young age, I would say by fifth grade, definitely by sixth grade, I saw how clearly both the racial and class lines were drawn. And I imagine that not just academically did that experience allow me to get where I am, but it also was definitely shaping my thinking and my understanding of the world.
Were you treated differently by your friends in the neighborhood? Because you...
I never experienced that. I know a lot of Black people say it was kind of hard to straddle those two worlds. I've never mm-hmm. experienced that. It was never a problem for me.
You know, you became really celebrated as a journalist for the work you did at ProPublica on education. Mm-hmm. And you've talked a lot about your continued belief in desegregation. You've charted in some of your writing families of generations of families that went to segregated schools, families because of Brown versus Board of Education went to integrated schools, and now the resegregation of schools. Talk about the importance to you of desegregation and whether the idea of separate but equal, which Brown versus Education was to eradicate, is even possible, the notion that you can be separate but equal?
Definitely. Well, first, let me say, just in terms of terms, I don't believe in desegregation. I believe in integration. And I mm-hmm. don't think that those are the same thing. Mm-hmm. When I was one of five Black kids in my all-white elementary school, that was not integration. That was allowing a handful of us in to someone else's school where we did not share in that school, in the culture, and it never was our school. I believe in integration, which is about not tokenism. It's not just one way. It includes the educators and where we're actually building schools that are serving multiple populations. That I do believe in. I don't think that anything about the way that we understand racial hierarchy in this country and the study of history or even the present would lead us to believe that separate can be equal in this country. Can separate be equal? Of course, right? There's nothing about white kids that makes Black kids smarter or makes Black kids want to learn. It is certainly possible to have all Black schools that are excellent That is possible. The problem is we have never, for a single day in this country, provided the same resources to Black schools as we have to white schools. Right now, a majority Black and Latino schools nationwide get about $28 billion less in funding every year than majority white schools. And on top of that, Black schools now are also facing a double segregation. They also are often of concentrated poverty, which we know is just not good for the learning environment. So we have kids that are the most disadvantaged societally being placed in schools with the fewest resources. So I would like, you know, I didn't put my daughter in, I put my daughter in a segregated school on purpose. And I think that Black people should certainly have the choice if they want to put their kid in a school that where the kids look like them. You know, it's not fun to spend your whole life as one of a tiny minority in every environment that you've ever been in. But we have just never treated Black kids the same when they are separated. We see that in every school district in the country where there are significant numbers of Black kids.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. One thing that interested me is that you were exposed in your high school to a book be called Before the Mayflower, and that really planted a seed for you about the history that you're now so closely associated with telling.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing what high school, the path that high school can actually lead you on. It was my high school, which was, I was bused into that high school, was about 20% Black. And we, it offered a one semester Black Studies elective. And in that one semester, I learned more about the history of Black people than I had learned in my entire education to that point. And I kind of became obsessed with learning the history. So when that class ended, I asked that teacher, who was the only Black male teacher I ever had, Mr. Ray Dial, to keep giving me more books. I started self-study. And one of the books he put in my hand was Before the Mayflower. And so it was I believe, as a junior in high school that I came across the date 1619. And I remember how powerful that date was to me, because I was just absolutely shocked that Black people had been here that long and that slavery started that long ago. And I understood that there was a reason no one told us that date, that that date held a power and that erasure held a power. It was also in that same class that I joined my high school newspaper, because the same teacher, I went to him and I complained about how our high school paper didn't write about the Black kids at our school and the challenges that we faced. And he said, well, either join the paper and write those stories yourself, or shut up and don't come in here and complain anymore. So that's what I did. So it's just so, you know, you couldn't have predicted this, but it was that same teacher, that same class, that brought together these two areas of my life, journalism and understanding of 1619 and the power of that history, to create the project that people now know me for.
Is that teacher still living? Do you keep in touch with him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were actually just texting the other day. I tell him, you know, I say his name all the time. And yep, he is, and he's still in Iowa, and he's now a preacher.
Ah, well, he must be proud of what he launched in you.
Yes, for sure.
The you went to Notre Dame. Why did you choose to go to Notre Dame? It's kind of an interesting choice.
So I was, you know, I had a lot of colleges recruiting me in high school. I had good grades. I tested very well. I took, you know, the hardest classes that my high school offered. And I was totally overwhelmed by the choices, having never been away from home. But I knew I had to go to a school that was within driving distance, because my parents could not afford to fly me home if I wanted to come home for holidays. I wanted to be somewhere that was close to a city with Black people in it. And I wanted a school that had a prestigious name, because I believed that if I could attach myself to a prestigious school, I wouldn't have to spend my whole life proving to people that I was a smart Black person. So those were the three things. And I was working at the grocery store one day, and this guy came in. His name was LaShane Sadler. He had a Notre Dame Letterman jacket on. And I was like, I'd never heard of a Black person who'd gone or met a Black person who went to Notre Dame. And I asked him if he went there. He said yes. So I went home and I looked it up. There wasn't internet, at least I didn't have internet at that time. And I went home and looked it up in our World Book Encyclopedia set.
Yes.
And I saw that it was, it was about 6-hour drive. I looked up the demographics and I decided to apply there. It was the only school that I applied to.
But smart as you are, you had a really hard time there when you first arrived. You almost flunked out of there, so it must have been a rough initiation there. Tell me about that.
It was so Notre Dame was never challenging for me. Well, I won't say it wasn't challenging for me academically, but I never struggled there in terms of being able to do the work. But I certainly struggled culturally. Notre Dame is a very elite place. It is also very, it's quite conservative for mm-hmm. a college campus, and also very, very small Black population. And I really struggled with the race and class dynamics there. I was called, a nigger for the first time at Notre Dame. It was really hard. Mm-hmm. And I think I went, I don't think I realized it at the time, but I certainly went into a depression my first year, and I just stopped going to class. I just felt so uncomfortable there. I earned my first F's in my life at Notre Dame, my very first report card. I tried to get the mail before my parents got it, but I didn't get there quite fast enough. And I had a B, a C, and 3 F's on my report card. And second semester was almost as bad. And I remember my parents talking to me, and they're like, "Do you know what it's taken for us to, help you financially in a school like this? Like, you cannot fail." And I got called in second semester. I was on academic probation. I got called in to the dean of freshman year. I'd never met this woman before in my life. The first time we ever met was when she called me in to tell me that I should withdraw from Notre Dame because mm-hmm. I was going to be kicked out for my academic performance, and it would be much easier for me to get into another school if I withdrew as opposed to got kicked out. And I remember leaving that meeting so angry that she never asked me once why I was struggling. She knew I couldn't make it. And I knew I could make it. I knew I wasn't going to class, but that the work wasn't hard. So I left that meeting actually determined to prove her wrong. And that's what I did. There was a Black dean there who approved me to take a double load at summer school. I took, I think, 6 classes at summer school that summer. I caught up and I graduated on time. So, I almost didn't make it, but my whole life, I have always used people underestimating me as motivation when I wasn't able to find motivation elsewhere.
Probably not the best way to motivate someone, but motivation nonetheless. When the 1619 Project surfaced, and it created such a stir last year when the Times devoted a whole magazine to it, which everyone should read, by the way, because it's just such a stunning piece of work. The Federalist found a letter that you had written when you were a student at Notre Dame, and you were responding to a piece called God Bless Columbus, and you had a line in there saying the white race is the biggest murderer, rapist, pillager, and thief of the modern world.
That was a line.
Yes, and likened Columbus to Hitler. Now, first of all, let me say, I don't know anyone who necessarily wants to be held to every word that they wrote when they were 19 years mm-hmm. old. But that was for you at Notre Dame to write that letter was quite a statement. And I was wondering, what kind of reaction did it elicit when you published it?
You know, I honestly don't remember. I didn't even remember writing that letter. I'm 44 years old now. That was so long ago. And when I saw the letter, and I started reading it, I was like, I wrote this? So then I had to do some research and look up what it was that I was responding to. And then it all kind of came back to me. So yes, I was 19. I was at a university where I felt extremely racially isolated. I was very angry, which is clear. We had been joining in protests. The Black Student Union had been joining in protests with one of the Native American groups against these racist Christopher Columbus murals in the administration building. And this guy wrote this editorial where he basically justified genocide and said that, you know, Native people were rapists and cannibals, and Columbus did us all a favor. I was so, so if you notice, the Federalist, it does not publish or point to the article that I was responding to. I was so hurt for my friends that they would have to read something like that. And the opening line of that letter I wrote is, how dare the Observer publish such a racist thing? And then I decided I was going to match tone for tone. I think it was a poor attempt at satire. I was going to match tone for tone what he was saying about Native people, I was going to say about white people. And I ended by saying, how does it feel to have your entire race written about in that way? I don't remember.
Interesting. I just have that quote because that's the quote that was. But I haven't seen the whole letter. But that's kind of important context.
It is important context. Now, again, would I write that today? Of course not. You know, you do a lot of shit when you're 19 that you wouldn't do now. But I certainly didn't think it was presented fairly, and it wasn't presented in the context. And I don't remember the response on campus. I'm sure it was hot. That was a heated time. There were heated debates happening. But in some ways, you know, I sent it to my editor, and I was like, Federalist found this thing I wrote when I was 19. And she was like, that sounds like you. So I was sharpening my writing arsenal, but, you know, at 44 years old, I certainly would not have written it that way. But I would have definitely stood up for my friends.
Speaking of your writing arsenal and your reporting arsenal, you went to the University of North Carolina to study journalism, but you had made a decision. You spent a year in Atlanta. You had made a decision that you wanted to dig deep into these structural disparities that were very, very clear in this country. I mean, that was a conscious decision on your part, that this is what you wanted to write about.
Yes. So I was a history and African-American studies major at Notre Dame. And I took that year off because I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a historian or a journalist, and I needed to figure it out. And ultimately, I decided on journalism because journalists write for the masses. And I felt like you can reach a lot more people and maybe actually change your society. But I've always been deeply influenced by how empowering history has been for me. That understanding the architecture upon which these inequalities were built calmed me. And it helped me understand that, what they're saying about why Black people live in these conditions is not actually true. This is a constructed inequality, and history teaches you how it was constructed. So I knew that in becoming a journalist, I had to always be mining that history and always using that history to inform my work and inform the reader. So yeah, that is why I wanted to become a journalist, to really wed those two loves in a way that I hoped would help people better understand the country that we live in.
You know, I live in Chicago a few blocks from a boulevard that's named for Ida B. Wells. and a lot of our listeners probably don't know who Ida B. Wells is, but Chicagoans do, and you do, because she was a kind of a role model for you.
Absolutely. So I was actually, I spoke at that street renaming in Chicago. I was there for that event, and I was very proud because it's a major thoroughfare where oftentimes those types of street renamings don't happen in major thoroughfares. So Ida B. Wells, of course, was an investigative journalist. She was a Black woman born into slavery who began investigating lynchings right at the end of Reconstruction. It was an incredibly dangerous time to be Black in this country. And as the South was trying to reinstate the racial order of slavery, they began a reign of terror against particularly Black men, but Black people in general. And the kind of common justification for lynchings was that Black men were raping white women. And Ida B. Wells began to investigate the real reasons behind lynchings. And that's how, you know, her newspaper was burned down for writing about the true causes of lynchings, and also that there were many consensual relationships between Black men and white women. She was also a suffragist. She was a civil rights activist. She was one of the original co-founders of the NAACP. So she's long been kind of, I call her my spiritual grandmother, because when I was thinking about wanting to be an investigative journalist, I didn't see a Black woman doing what I wanted to do, but I had this historical icon who was little known to most Americans, but not to me.
Yeah, she had to flee Memphis. That's how she ended up in Chicago, because her reporting was so threatening that she put herself in jeopardy. She also was a big thorn in the side of the suffragettes.
Yes, she was.
Because they were campaigning for the right to vote for women, but not for women of color. But she saw it as a step forward, and she devoted herself to that. You went out to Portland and spent 5 years at the Oregonian, which is the big paper out there. And you had your battles there with because you wanted to do this work, and your editors were hesitant to allow you to do it.
Yes. So I think that it's always important when people see someone who has garnered a certain level of acclaim in their career to understand that the path has often not been easy, and that many of the challenges that many younger Black journalists, brown journalists face, many of us who have some success now have faced those as well. I went to Portland with the understanding that I wanted to write about race. And once I got there, however, that understanding seemed to disappear. And I was really marginalized for wanting to write stories about racial inequality. I was told that I was, you know, I was too biased. I was showing my bias, that this wasn't the reporting that the vast majority of the Oregonian's readership wanted. And I really struggled. I nearly left the industry at that point because, but when I got there in 2006, I left in 2011. As many of the listeners may know, this is when the news industry was in a free fall. Newspapers were laying off, you know, thousands of people across the country. And so I couldn't leave. There weren't other jobs to go to. And I also couldn't write about what I got into journalism to write about. So I just really thought strongly about leaving. And almost all of my friends of journalists of color who had come into the Oregonian with me had left before I did. And the only reason I didn't leave was I just couldn't think of what else I wanted to do with my life. I'd wanted to be a journalist since I was in high school, and I've always felt that this is like my calling. So I couldn't leave because I couldn't figure out anything else to do, and I stuck it out. And that's when Steve Engelberg called me and wanted me to apply to ProPublica. And we had a conversation. I mean, the first conversation we had was, I told him I'm not going to come if I can't write about race, that I don't need to leave one bad situation for another. And he assured me that that's exactly why they wanted me. And the rest is history.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. As we talked about earlier, you dug deep into education and segregation patterns in education and the allocation of resources in education and so on, and shone a bright light there. By the way, I just want to point out parenthetically that issue of local news organizations failing is still a huge, huge problem for our country, and is continues to this day. And you know, there are great organizations like ProPublica and others that have sprung up, but the hole is big and needs to be filled, because that light needs to shine on local institutions, not just nationally. But this led you to the Times and the 1619 Project flowed from that. I know I'm compressing some history here,
okay.
But talk to me about how that came about and what your mission was with the 1619 Project.
For the 1619 Project? So we talked about this. I've been thinking about the year 1619 since high school. And people who know me know that it's a date that I bring up and evoke often. And as the anniversary, so the end of 2018, I had been on book leave for about a year and a half. It was supposed to be a year, but as you know, it's hard to meet a book deadline.
Yes, I do know.
So I was getting ready to come back to work and thinking about, well, I've been gone for a year and a half. What's the first thing I want to work on when I get back? And I just kept thinking about that was going to be the 400th anniversary of the beginning of American slavery. And yet almost no Americans, you know, few Americans had ever heard of that date. And so that it was probably just going to pass with almost no acknowledgement or recognition, like so many things having to do with slavery and the Black experience. And I wanted to use my platform at the Times to force 1619 into the national lexicon, if possible, you know, just a small little goal.
Yeah, right. Well, if you're going to shoot big.
And I had, you know, so I was thinking, like, how could you do that? And simply writing like one piece just was far too small to assess a 400-year legacy of an institution that is so foundational to the American story, but yet has been treated as an asterisk to the American story. And I've long argued that if you name anything in American life, I can trace it back to slavery. So I started thinking, well, we should actually we should take over an entire issue of the magazine and look at all of these different American institutions that we think have nothing to do with slavery and show how they do. And that's really what the idea was and how it was born. So I was back at the Times for maybe a week, and I pitched the idea of doing a special issue on the 400th anniversary, but an issue that wasn't going to be about just the past, but that was really going to be about the ongoing modern legacy, that it was going to, every story would start with today and trace it back. And I knew I wanted to do democracy and capitalism, music, and why we're the only Western industrialized country without universal healthcare. And then we convened a bunch of scholars to brainstorm about what should some of the other pieces be. But that was how it began.
Yeah, and that's what's extraordinary about it, is it's not just the history of slavery, but the history of the legacy of slavery onto this day, and dealing with things like infrastructure and how highways were built to segregate people, and of course education and healthcare and the wealth gap, and the systemic things that were done that result in what we see today. This whole issue of systemic racism that's not jargon. That is history. And what you did that I think is so important is, and all of those who worked on the project with you, is to really, really draw those lines to this day. And now you're expanding this to book form. Speaking of book deadlines that are probably hanging over you.
I think the power of the project is that it is rooted in the now. That had we simply done a history, yes, people would have learned some things, but I don't think they would have engaged with it the same way, because, you know, Black people hear all the time, slavery was a long time ago, why don't you get over it? And I wanted this project to show that we can't get over something that's so foundational and that we have not dealt with. And we can't get over it as Black people because our country hasn't gotten over it. And so we are expanding into a series of books. There are going to be books from picture books for young children to middle school, older readers, and then an adult book. And I'm We're working on the adult book right now, which is going to come out next year. And I'm so excited about it because we're adding about 8 additional essays, many of them written by some of the preeminent historians in their fields. And we get to expand in, you know, into areas that the original project didn't get to cover and further bolster our argument. And I think continue to hopefully transform our understanding of this country.
You know that that in the main, that the project was widely praised by historians, but some historians were critical just of a couple of aspects of it. One was the assertion that the Revolutionary War was fought to preserve the institution of slavery. And the other was that the Civil War was not fought over slavery. I could read their critiques, but their general critiques, you know. Explain to me how you receive those critiques, and has it caused you to change your thinking in any way?
Yeah, so the main criticism is the single line in my essay where I say that one of the primary reasons that the colonists chose to revolt was a preservation of slavery. What I will say is, in hindsight, I should have been more careful with my language, and I should have provided more evidence of the claim, because in not doing so, I left it open to exactly what has happened since then. I didn't sit at home one day and say, I'm just going to make up something about the American Revolution. I got that from the work of historians. And this is actually the revolutionary period, and particularly the role of slavery in the motivations of colonists, particularly in Virginia, Georgia, and South Carolina, is hotly contested in the field of historiography and early American history, which I did not know when I kind of dropped that bomb in the middle of my essay, that I was stepping into a major argument that is being had in the field right now. And I should have been more savvy about understanding how deeply we as a society want to protect the purity of our founding. And we don't learn the narratives that another motivation was the desire to take more indigenous lands, and that another motivation was the desire not to pay off their debts, the colonists' debts. And then, of course, also the desire to be to have representation, a representative government. So there were all of these things happening back then, but I did not provide enough evidence and left myself open for criticism. And believe me when I say in the book, I will be providing all of the source material for that claim. So I think anyone would have been extremely naive to think that you could produce a project like this that says, what if we were to consider 1619 our true founding and not 1776, and that Black people are the perfecters of our democracy and the true founding fathers, and not think you're going to get some pushback. Of course you are. And I think criticism is good. It sharpens your argument. No one produces perfection ever, and historians argue with each other all the time. What has been difficult has been the extent to which a small group of people have really tried to discredit the project, not simply to say, we don't agree with that. We wouldn't have written that. We wouldn't have written it that way. We don't think there's enough evidence of that claim, but to actually try to say that the entire project should be discredited and not be taught or not be considered, that has been unexpected, and that has been difficult. And I certainly didn't see a year later that it would become part of the national
election. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, well, I mean, it is part of the national conversation, because race is very much part of this election and the politics of our moment, as it's been the part of the politics of almost every moment during the course of America's life. But yeah, there's legislation the California schools, for example, want to make this 1619 project part of their curriculum for students. Other states, I think, will follow. Other communities will follow. President has threatened to withhold federal funding, which he can't do, to states who include the project in its teaching. I think Senator Cotton has introduced a bill to that effect. So yeah, you're part of the politics of the moment. Let's talk about the politics of the moment. You know, I was among those who was out marching, after George Floyd's murder, and my wife Susan turned to me and she said, "This is important. This is nice, but what happens next?
Yeah,
you know, are we just here to make ourselves feel good, or are we? What happens next? What is going to happen?" Is there, I mean, you see in polling some change in attitudes, but how do you assess the moment in which we're in? Because I've seen quotes where you weren't particularly hopeful about whether this is really a hinge point in history or whether this is really a moment of progress.
Yeah, I don't tend to be a hopeful person in general. Doesn't ever feel that useful in my life. But so I don't know, you know. In June, I wrote a piece, a cover story for the magazine called What is Old? And I argued that this period felt different from what we had seen before. And that in order to make it different, we had to ask for much larger reforms than simply laws that say police can't kill you without consequence. And at that time, when we were still seeing daily protests and wall-to-wall coverage of the protests, and the protests were in all 50 states and had been sustained for weeks upon weeks, it felt like we were right at the edge of something transformative. I'm already feeling like that is slipping away, mm-hmm. that attention to sustained efforts to reduce inequality and to truly transform our society. The attention span is always fleeting in this country, and it doesn't take long before folks are ready to move on or feel very primed to those who say, okay, it's getting out of hand now. So, you know, it was fine as long as nobody was rioting. And now that some folks haven't behaved properly, then, you know, it's time to move on to other things. So I'm really worried. I'm worried that the steam is running out and that the people who views were changing are starting to slip back.
You know, I want to ask you about the rioting. The president obviously has seized on the rioting, which doesn't, there were millions of people who were marching in this country. And the rioting represents a small portion of those people, but how do you interpret that? Because most people would look at that and see this destruction and arson and so on as kind of polluting the cause or deterring the cause, and the president obviously has seized on it and blown it up to say it's right. Personally threatening. How do you see that, and do you have a message about that?
I mean, one, let me just say, I think it's fundamentally unfair to expect that people organizing protests control the behavior of every single person who shows up to a protest. And especially people, you know, the rioting typically is occurred after the formal protests are over.
Yeah.
I don't know how people are expected to control the behavior of other people, especially when organizers are clearly not promoting rioting or property damage. And so it always feels like we're just looking for an excuse so that we don't really have to engage in the transformative change that's necessary. The other thing is, we know that we spend so much time condemning property damage. And that actually sends a message to people. It sends a message that if you want folks to pay attention, that you have to do something like that to get folks to pay attention. And so it ends up being this counterintuitive. When Trump goes to Kenosha and doesn't speak on the police brutality that led people to the streets, but speaks on someone's property being damaged, it only affirms why people are out in the streets in the first place, which is that we are a country that seems to value things over Black lives. So no, I don't know any reputable person who would condone the destruction of property or violence of any kind. But I also think that unfair focus on that and the expectation that people, you know, the police can't police themselves. That's why people are out in the streets right now. And these are people who are being paid to do that. But the expectation is that those who are leading protests can somehow police every single person who shows up to a protest. It's just not fair.
It's also important to note that the people who are making the most of the rioting as a political issue are so hesitant to condemn counter-protesters who have been a source of violence and death.
Yes. Not even hesitant. There's a refusal.
Yeah.
So while, you know, Black Lives Matter protesters are expected to be held accountable for everything that anyone who comes, and many of these, again, people have nothing to do with it. And actually, it's been shown that some of them are actually white nationalists who are intentionally being destructive. No one is expecting that same type. You know, the young man who shot and killed those people in Kenosha.
Yeah, 17 years old.
Right, said that he was representative of counter-protesters, and those counter-protesters were not expected to condemn him, and in fact, they refused to.
And the president offered a defense of him. So
yes, he did. So when you think about that, when I said on national TV that you should not call burning a building down, you should not use the same terminology about violence when you're talking about burning a building down as you do as police killing a Black man. I got dozens of threats of people who said, I'm going to come burn your house down. But when the president somehow says it is okay, it's not okay to burn down this camera shop, but it is okay, you know, I can understand why he had to shoot and kill someone. It actually makes the whole point of the movement that, we are valuing certain things like property over the lives of human beings.
Do you get many threats, and is that a concern?
I never did until the 1619 Project, and yeah, now I do, but I'm not concerned about it, no.
You talk about, the big sort of transformational change that's necessary. Tell me what that would look like. What does big transformational change look like to you?
So if we're talking about to address racial inequality, of course, I think the biggest change that needs to occur is we need to pass a reparations bill. I make the argument in my piece, What Is Owed, that almost everything about what makes Black life so hard is the wealth disparity and the forced wealth poverty that Black Americans experience. You can't fix everything, but that certainly would substantially change the material lives of Black Americans and the vulnerability that Black Americans face in everything from housing to schools to ability to get a college education, to ability to just feed your family or weather a financial storm. I also think that we need strong enforcement of existing civil rights laws. Literally every time they measure it, Black people are facing rampant discrimination in the housing market, lending, in employment. And we have decent laws on the books, but those laws aren't being enforced.
So I would guess some of your neighbors in Waterloo and other places in Iowa who are struggling themselves right now, white working class people would reject this and say, I don't feel privileged at all. I'm struggling. Maybe I've got drug issues. I've got, I'm going through some of these very, very same things. And there's strong resistance. The idea of reparations is jet fuel for Trump and his politics for this reason, because his is a politics of resentment. What do you say to your former neighbors? I know you don't live in Waterloo anymore. You probably get less of that argument in Brooklyn, but you could probably find some people who would make it. Tell me what you would say to them if they were sitting here.
Well, first, to be clear, reparations is not paid by white people. Reparations is paid by the federal government. And if you understand that reparations is to address a specific legacy of chattel slavery and anti-blackness, where black people were excluded from the ability to accumulate wealth over time, then it is about a societal debt and not an individual.
Yeah, you call it restitution.
Right. And it is restitution. And this, and the other thing I would say is I also am strongly in support of universal anti-poverty programs. I don't think we should be having these conversations in isolation. I do believe in universal health care. I believe in a universal basic income. I believe that every American should be able to have access to safe and quality housing. We can do those things to address the poor and also understand that the experience of Black Americans is a singular experience. There is a singular disadvantage. One does not argue that because someone else has diabetes, we can't spend money on cancer research. You don't make that argument. You have to address this particular harm. And what I try to show in the piece that I wrote is even amongst the poor, white poor are advantaged compared to Black poor. White poor don't live in the typical white people in poverty don't live in areas of concentrated poverty. They actually have more wealth than the average middle class Black family. Their children attend on average a middle class white school. So even poverty is racialized in this country. But again, I'm not arguing that reparations be paid and then we do nothing to help the least of these in amongst all races. We can do all of those things, and we should be advocating to do all of those things.
I asked you as we leave, you have a child, maybe mm-hmm. right in that very room.
Yeah, she just came in.
you said that you're sort of losing hope that of change. What do you say to her about the world and what she is facing? Just as your father spoke with you back in the day about what the burdens you would have to face would be.
Yeah, I think every Black parent tries to simultaneously preserve as much of your child's innocence as possible, but also give them the armor to go out into the world. That's what I try to do with my daughter. She is very aware of racial inequality and very aware of racial injustice. She's also very aware that she is much more privileged than most of the kids who look like her. To me, while I don't have hope that we are going to see a transformed America, I certainly have hope in my own life and what I'm able to do and provide for my own child. And I see my work as trying to expand those opportunities for other children like her and other people like our community.
Well, I must say, anyone who reads the 1619 Project and your other work would need to take it to heart because the case is so compelling. The history is so stunning. And we should say that it is not demeaning of America to say this is a part of our history that we need to reconcile with. And in fact, to say we love and believe in the American ideal enough that we're willing to work to see the country live up to it. And that's how I viewed the 1619 Project and your work. And I am an idealist about this country. I'm the son of an immigrant. I've seen what it's meant to me and my family. But it's a work in progress. And we can't get to where we want to go unless we reconcile with this history and do what's necessary and to make that right and to affect change. So I appreciate the work that you've done and that you'll continue to do. And it'll mean a lot, to a lot of young people across this country over time, I hope. Anyway, Nicole, it's great to be with you. Good luck.
Thank you.
I look forward to your book and other works.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.